I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lope, and I'm WNYC and WNYC.org. Last month, saxophonist and bandleader Robbie Coltrane signed with legendary Blue Note Records, one of the last great remaining jazz labels. It was made famous in part by the 1957 recording of Blue Train by Robbie's father, John Coltrane. Not confined by the legacy of his father and mother, Alice Coltrane, Robbie is an innovative composer and bandleader, and he's considered one of today's top jazz saxophonists, as you can tell. His quartet opened a six-night stand last night at the Village Vanguard, and he's been kind enough to drop by our studio today. Welcome, Robbie.
Andy, hi. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You don't know what time of day it is. You're a jazz musician.
I'm still in the jazz club. I'm still in the club right now.
I'm kind of blown away that you're here. Because, I mean, I think if I were doing... Well, first of all, I couldn't have done that. But if I had played a gig last night, I think I'd just be kind of sleeping it off. When did you roll in from your gig last night? When did you get home?
I honestly don't want to know. Because it actually wouldn't really represent how I normally kind of go about working and dealing with my two kids, my wife, and being
That's you.
I'm at home.
You live in Park Slope,
bed by
right?
8:30 normally every night.
You live in Park Slope?
I do, yes.
Yeah, so you're a very kind of, you have a very kind of respectable veneer.
You have to be respectable in Park Slope. They don't let you in if you don't have a baby stroller or something.
That's right. Put in some time at the food co-op, or you haven't gone that far?
That was in my old neighborhood. I was on Sterling for about 10 years. Now we're on 14th, so a little bit further away. But I do like the slope. I missed the tornado. I missed it.
You did.
I was at JFK, actually, when the tornado went down.
Well, now, tell me about how was opening night last night? The Village Vanguard, that's a big deal.
I love the Village Vanguard.
Yeah.
Lorraine Gordon is, owns, operates, runs that club and has been there for thousands of years. And it really feels like home there. You know, I love listening to music in that space. I love performing there. And last night, it was the greatest night of music ever. Let me just put it that way.
Okay.
Well, let me say it again. It was a good night. It was an opening night.
An opening night.
Sometimes, you know, well, my band, my music, I think that we benefit from having a little momentum. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? It's a little esoteric what we're doing, and we really rely on kind of feeling each other out, feeling the music. You know, we really rely on listening to each other, and sometimes that has to build up a little bit over a few nights.
It's funny that you say it's esoteric, because as I was listening to you play just in that little clip, I was thinking just how incredibly accessible it is. So I hate to pull the rug out from under you, but you're actually doing something that I like. So it can't be that esoteric.
Well,
sometimes I hear things that do strike me as kind of, you know, off-putting, or I can't get into it. But that sort of got me right away.
I appreciate that. I think that, you know, my goal isn't to be esoteric. My goal isn't to be, you know, wild or this or that. My goal is just to make music, you know.
Right.
But I feel like, you know, stretching a little bit and trying to push should be a component of playing jazz today, you know. And I think often musicians are, you know, we learn how to play a style that was, you know, created many, many decades ago.
Right.
And we say, okay, now I'm a jazz musician. I can play just like Sonny Rollins or Joe Henderson. And so that means I'm a jazz musician. But I always felt like, well, those guys didn't do that. They had their, you know, the people that came before them that helped them develop their styles, but they weren't just content with just playing the way that they learned. It was more about the pursuit of finding something unique or special that kind of drove them. And I feel that needs to be something that we recognize in jazz today. You know, it's not just about let's deal with the history of the music and only play the history of music. It's like, well, let's embrace the history, but also, try to look forward a little bit, you know.
Well, you're an innovator, and you...
Oh, no. Don't go on record saying that, please.
I can't say you're an innovator?
Well, you've said it through. It's on the airways, so it's on record.
It's already been said.
It's on the record now.
But you just, you know, you said in your own way that you like to say what's new, and how do you approach that? I mean, how do you find the new sounds? How do you, when you're composing, is it just, you know, well, what's your process? Tell me a little bit about that. Is it like a magician revealing his tricks?
Trial and error.
Just trial and error.
I think, I feel like, you know, it would be easy for us to learn every single thing that's already been put on record and only do that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have a successful career doing that. I play jazz because this is, you know, what I, you know, what I've learned. And or you take all that knowledge and you try things, not knowing what the outcome might be, you know. And if the majority of things that don't work, you know, don't work, that's okay. And if a few things do work, you look at those things and you try to you know, expand on those ideas, you know. So I'm all about trying and failing, you know what I mean? Because there's going to be one time, you know, where it's, something actually
that's
works,
right.
and then you start from there. You go, you lead from that.
Your band has been together 7 years.
About 7 years.
Seven years. Is that a long time in the jazz world with people, you know, getting along well enough to keep playing together? Or?
Well, maybe nowadays, yes. Maybe you know, in the history of jazz, it was more common that. Musicians stayed as groups longer, you know. Now, you know, everyone, you know, we're freelancers, you know, and we all need to work. And my bassist, my drummer, and my piano player, if they're not playing with me, they're literally playing with, you know, a dozen other groups, you know. But there is a real benefit, I feel, you know, keeping this collective together. You know, you start kind of, you know, it's like a family, really. You know, you start finishing each other's sentences musically and really getting inside, you know, each other's thoughts musically. And it really, it starts to really, you know, focus the music and take it into a kind of a unique place, I think. You know.
Now, speaking of family, obviously you grew up in a musical family. You grew up with legends. And was that a double-edged sword? I mean, obviously, you know, you developed a love of music, and there's probably a lot of music in your house that
sure.
that originally got you started and excited. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my dad was a corporate lawyer in Cleveland, so if I had decided to become a corporate lawyer in Cleveland, I would have had that burden to deal with. Did you ever think, man, this is gonna be tough? Because not just your dad, but your mom
sure.
as well. You know, they're both you know, at the pinnacle.
You know, I the environment that I grew up in, I grew up, you know, during the 70s in the San Fernando Valley in you know, Los Angeles.
What town in San Fernando?
I grew up in Woodland Hills.
Oh, yeah.
It's about 40 minutes from, you know, west of downtown Los Angeles. You know the West Coast?
Yeah, I lived out there for 15 years.
Oh, okay.
I lived in West LA, though.
So, 15 years, that's enough.
That's enough. That's more than enough.
I put my tenure in, that was enough. I was born in New York. I basically grew up in LA, and I moved back to New York in 91. So I was, you know, there for 20 years, and I've been here almost 20 years. So I'm still trying to figure out if I'm a West Coaster or an East Coaster. But the environment I grew up in was very normal. It was very, you know, what the Valley's like.
That's right, suburban. You
know, sure. A lot of people are not thinking about jazz. This is the 70s again, and a lot of people didn't know who John Coltrane was. So I grew up kind of anonymously, you know, riding my bike around, acting like a goofball like most kids do.
And what kind of music were you listening to in the 70s?
I know, everything that was on the radio, you know what I mean? A lot of R&B, a lot of pop music. You know, I was a huge Beatles fan. I still mm-hmm. am, you know. I wasn't, you know, I was listening to a lot of classical music as well during that time, too. Not a lot of jazz, was not listening to jazz, you know. So I, you know, for me to, you know, the desire to play the saxophone, the desire to get involved with jazz music was really, you know, it wasn't set off by the fact that my parents were musicians. You know, the fact that my mom was still very active in music, you know, exposed me to a lot of great music. And I think that was just, you know, really my love for music sort of brought me to playing the saxophone and jazz. So the you know, there wasn't a sense of like a pressure, like an external pressure, like an internal pressure where I'm feeling mm-hmm. like, okay, they want me to do this. My mom wants me to, everyone wants me to play the saxophone. So I guess I should do that. You know, that is never a good reason to,
no.
to you know, the saxophone is like a, you know, like any creative pursuit or craft or art. It's like, it's a lifetime of work. You know what I mean? And sometimes at work it can be, you know, not always that rewarding, you know, and you really have to love it. You really have to love what you're committing yourself to, you know, and to do it with for any other reasons, it's you're not going to really make it. So I never had that type of internalized pressure. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when your father's a famous actor, and then it's like, of course you have to act too, but you watch him every day and he's in movies, and now you're, you know, that's really different. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you really feel like, like you're living for this other being. You know, I didn't grow up with my father. I didn't see him every day. And that would have been tough. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know, feeling like I have to emulate this person, and I look up to him and I aspire to him, you know. You know, I'm just another guy with a saxophone in that regard. You know what I mean? You know, I was turned on by music. I was turned on by my father's music, of course, like everyone else who plays, you know, the saxophone. And it pushed me toward, you know, wanting to make music. You know?
This is Andy Borowitz filling in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Ravi Coltrane, saxophonist, philosopher.
And not an innovator. I'm going on the record.
The least innovative man I've ever met. We're here at WNYC and WNYC.org. Now, you did, you know, you grew up with your mom's music.
Mm-hmm.
She's a jazz musician. And she was putting out records in the 60s. And then she stopped recording mm-hmm. for a spell. What was the story behind that?
She got very involved in her religious and spiritual mm-hmm. activities or pursuits, you know. I think there was a period of time in the late 60s where a lot of people were embracing these Eastern philosophies. And maybe for most, it was kind of like something that was of the time, of the period, maybe even for some kind of a fad. But my mom really, really went very deep into it. So when everyone else was leaving the ashrams, she was starting one, you know what I mean? And she did start one in, you know, about 75 that still exists today. And that really became her focus, you know. Music, she always played, you know, but she, you know, decided that her, you know, the, you know, that she wasn't going to play publicly anymore. That wasn't really, you know, what she wanted to do. For a long time, and you know, as I was, you know, developing as a, you know, musician, I of course I wanted to work with my mom, wanted to play with her, but she was, you know, over here doing her thing, so I was always trying to encourage her to come and play a little bit. You know?
I want to play a track, and by the way, I've always wanted to say I want to play a track on the radio. That just makes me sound so much cooler than I am.
You've heard it here, folks.
Exactly, but I want to play. A track of Jagadishwar, if I pronounced that correctly.
Jagadishwar.
It's a song from Translinear Light by your mom, Alice Coltrane, that you played on and produced.
I produced this record. Okay. This is her last Impulse album. Yeah.
Let's take a listen. Now you you play this in your own shows, right?
We played it last night. Yeah, that's a song that I heard her play. You know, as a young boy, I'd come home from school and she'd be at the organ, just sitting playing songs quietly to herself and singing just quietly. You know, like there were hymns, really. You know, and I, you know, I didn't take much notice as a young kid, you know, how a young person's mind is, you know. It was definitely not in those serious types of, things, you know. But when we were putting that album together, it was around 2002 or 3, you know, I had a dream, and I heard that song in the dream. And I hadn't heard it probably in 15 years. I hadn't thought about it probably in that time. And I said, Ma, I think we should record this song, you know, and we did. Yeah.
It's interesting because you talk about your mother's spiritual journey, and to my ears at least, that song has kind of a transcendent mm-hmm. quality to it. It has mm-hmm. a sort of an ethereal, it's like she knows something we don't know, something like that.
She was a very, very special person, a very special person. I was honored to be able to work with her in that regard after, she raised me, and that she's really, you know, my only parent. My father died when I was only 2 years old. So my mother is, you know, that was the real guide for me. That she was a real, person that kind of got me, you know, to, you know, to, you know, become who I am today. I can't say enough about that, you know, but to work with her, you know, in that way was really just something very, very special for me.
Who are some of the other jazz giants in your life that you've been lucky enough to work with who've been a big influence on you?
First and foremost would have to be Elvin Jones, the great jazz drummer who played with my father's famous quartet in the 60s. He hired me right out of school. I was not ready to play on anybody's gig, on any stage. And I tried to express that to him, you know, like I'm basically still in school and I'm still learning how to, you know, play the saxophone. I still have to look down to find out where to, you know, to put my fingers to play C and, you know. And he was just very, very encouraging to me during that time. I think he said, you know, I'm kind of aware where you're at level-wise, but I want to help you get out there musically, you know. So Elvin was a huge influence on me. Jack DeJohnette, another great drummer, very, very important person to me, kind of a second father. Rashid Ali was a huge help to me. Before I moved to New York, I used to come, I went to a school called California Institute of the Arts from 86 to 90. But during the summer breaks, I would come to New York and hang out, and I'd stay with Rashid Ali in Soho, and he'd take me to clubs and jam sessions. And so he was a really very, very special person to me back in the day.
Well, Ravi, I want to thank you so much for being with us. I've been speaking with jazz saxophonist, non-innovator, Ravi Coltrane.
We're working on it.
The Ravi Coltrane Quartet will be performing at the Village Vanguard tonight through Sunday, September 26th. For more information and tickets, visit our show page at WNYC.org. Ravi, thanks again so much.
Andy, thank you very much.
Take it easy. Thank you.